Morning show at East Coast. I'd like to welcome into the studio this morning, and I'm here for a change when Minister Harris comes in. Simon, good morning to you.
Good morning, Declan. Thank you for having
me. Good morning. Missed you the last time.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, the hospice. We're all very excited about the plans there. So, what is the current situation? They had the special occasion on Friday night. Where are we?
So, look, the hospice in Wicklow is now built. And let me be very clear. It's built on the back of the generosity of the people of Wicklow and the most amazing community effort. A small group of dedicated people working for about 10 years now, literally 10 years, have managed to build the most amazing hospice. I went down to visit it a couple of weeks ago in Maharamore, there just down the side of the beehive. And it's effectively built now. It now needs to be fitted out. And I was very pleased on Friday to confirm that my department will provide the full funding for the running costs of the hospice, which will come in at about 4 million a year. So that has now given them the certainty to go ahead and recruit the doctors, the nurses, and to fit out the building. So the Wicklow hospice, after years of people campaigning for it, looking for it, shaking buckets, running marathons and everything else in this great county, will open to patients in January. It'll be a 15-bed inpatient palliative care network, and it will be run by Our Lady's Hospice, which will be known by to many listeners who will also run Blackrock Hospice and Harold's Cross Hospice.
So opening in January.
Yes.
So what happens between now and then?
So basically, when I was standing in it about 3 or 4 weeks ago, to a layperson like me, it looks like it's finished. I understand there's a few small bits that the builders needed to finish. They've done a great job too. It's going to be handed over effectively from the builder's point of view this month. They will then fit it out, and they have the money to fit it out, and they'll obviously have to recruit staff. So between now and the end of the year, you recruit the staff, which I'm told they've already got quite a lot of interest for, which is good, and you fit out the building, and it will open officially in January.
And ongoing finance?
Ongoing finance will be provided by my department. So there's a really good collaboration in this country between community and the state when it comes to hospice care. Generally, the community pays for the capital costs, the building costs, and then the state rightly pays for the running costs, and that'll be the partnership model we have here.
So fundraising will have to continue for the capital.
Fundraising will continue for the Wicklow Hospice, as I suppose it does for every hospice. And in fairness to the community, there have been bank loans and everything. People have done a huge amount to get to this point. I'm delighted in the role that I have. Obviously being a Wicklow TD at the right time as well, to have been able to provide some funding towards the capital costs, but also to confirm the running costs.
Right, so we mustn't forget as well the community at Maharamore for their
and we should really
providing the site.
Yeah, absolutely, and thank you for reminding me of that, because as long with the amazing Wicklow Hospice Foundation, a very, very generous act by the nuns at Maharamore in donating a free site, and it's a really beautiful, picturesque site, and I think when people see the building, they're going to really be blown away by it. It's a really, really lovely feel to it, a lovely homely feel. I mean, no one wants to die. If you do have to die, people don't want to die in an acute hospital. People either want to die at home, and with this hospice will come more community palliative care nurses who can visit you in your home and care for your needs there. Or if you can't die at home, we'll actually have our own hospice now for the first time ever in our county. So a huge achievement that couldn't have happened if it wasn't for the generosity of people in our county, and as you rightly say, the generosity of the nuns at Maharamore also.
There's a subject that we've been covering on the programme that concerns the use of mesh for particularly women after childbirth, pelvic floor operations, even people with hernias, that a certain mesh is used, but has given, I believe, in about 10% of cases some difficulties. The practice is now stopped and reversed in some cases, but women are still suffering, particularly, as I say, women, but there are men. Mm. And as I say, we've been covering it, and the mesh survivors, they want a meeting with yourself, they want some action. Where are we with that?
And they're dead right in terms of action. So we've already taken some action. As you rightly say, I commissioned the Chief Medical Officer to carry out a full review of the use of mesh in Ireland. And on the basis of that review, I have paused indefinitely the use of mesh in the Irish Health Service. So these procedures that women were subjected to are no longer happening in the Irish Health Service. What we now need to do, though, is obviously care for those who have had very adverse impacts. And I, like you, have spoken to a number of them. I've met a number of them on a number of occasions. What I've been working on trying to do is put in place the supports to meet their health needs. I have received some funding in the budget to do this, and I'm scheduled to meet them again on Monday, where I hope to be able to update them on the HSE's plans to put in place support services. They're also asking me to carry out further investigations and inquiries, which I have not ruled out. In fact, I think there may well be merit in it. But what I've asked them to do is to outline to me the specific areas they would like further work to do. We already have the Chief Medical Officer's report, but in addition to that, what other areas would you like inquired to? And I'm very much an open mind and eager to help on that as well.
There's some unhappiness on social media, however, that you're only meeting a certain few and not as many that covers all the aspects.
Yeah, and this is kind of, you know, news to me as well. I'm more than happy to meet. I'm more than happy to meet everyone. There's obviously we need to work out the logistics. My understanding is there might be two separate advocacy groups, but I'm more than happy to meet both, either together or on separate occasions, whatever works best for them. But I'm more than happy to meet everyone. I've gained a lot in terms of an understanding of the issue from the meetings I've had already, and I'm eager to have more.
Yeah, what do you think the resolution of this will be? Do you see reversals? Is there technology there for it?
So the women feel very passionately that reversal should be made available in Ireland, and if it's not available in Ireland, that we need to support people going abroad for it. I mean, my instinctive approach to anything to do with our health service, and I think my record as health minister shows this, is I don't like the idea of people having to travel abroad to access health services. So I'd like to put in place the services here that give women the confidence that they can access the services here. To be honest, though, the needs of this group of people go beyond just the reversal. There's the psychological impact as well. I mean, you've had on your programme women speaking very openly about the very real impact it's had on their relationship, on their future plans, on their day-to-day life, on their careers. So it's about putting a whole package of support around to meet all of their needs. And I'm determined that we do this. Look, Mesh, there's different views in relation to it. My own view, my own understanding of it, from having listened to the women and having read the Chief Medical Officer's report, is that in some cases, Mesh might be merited. In other words, if you've tried everything else and you sit down with the patient and say, look, nothing else will work, what about Mesh and here are the risks, and then someone makes an informed decision. What seems to have happened here, based on the discussions I've had with women, was that it wasn't used as the last resort treatment and women were not made aware of all of the potential side effects and symptoms, some of which have been very, very devastating to people on a personal basis.
Yeah, there's chronic pain though with the women, and we've spoken to various practitioners around Mesh, one from Scotland, one from University Hospital in London. Mm-hmm. And they do their best to mitigate the problems, reverse it, etc. I mean, as they say, where will it end? I mean, there are successful, but 90%, I believe, of hernia for men and women are successful using Mesh. But it's these other people.
I mean, it's, so there's two jobs I have to do as health minister. One, I have to look after the people who've had a bad impact, and I'm determined to do that. And that's what my meeting on Monday is about. We have some funding in place. What do we need to do in terms of a package of supports and the potential for reversals and the likes, if that's what a woman chooses? The second thing I need to do, though, is to make sure that any procedure available in our country is safe. And what I don't want to do is rule out a procedure that could help somebody by not making it available. But I do need to make sure that there's full informed consent, that people are given all of the information and all of the facts, and I'm not convinced that happened in the past.
Okay. Two things that are in the news. One is the front page of the Irish Times, as we mentioned earlier on. Coombe made 52 calls to pest control since start of last year. Rodents and wasps and blue bottles and the silverfish, which I think are harmless, but they're annoying and whatever. They eat books and things. But there's lots of stuff, and they had to make 52 calls. You don't imagine 52 calls with rodents, etc., from a hospital.
No, I would imagine, and again, I'm obviously not involved in the day-to-day running of the Coombe, but as minister, of course, those headlines would get my attention. I mean, I would imagine it's down to two things. One, the fact that the building is very old, and secondly, the fact that there's very substantial building works going on in the community. As you know, it's very closely located to the site in the new Children's Hospital. But it seems to me that the hospital authorities are obviously doing everything appropriate, and there's no suggestion in the story that, you know, at any stage was any patient care compromised, and that's important as well.
Yeah. This is the Master I'm reading through in this particular article. It's critical, though, of progress on having the maternity hospital at St James's.
Look, we have a very ambitious plan to rebuild our four standalone maternity hospitals. So we have Hollis Street, we have the Rotunda, we have the Coombe, and we have Limerick. They're four maternity hospitals, excellent hospitals, but they're all standalone hospitals. The National Maternity Strategy says every maternity hospital should be co-located with an adult hospital for the odd and occasional time where sadly something goes wrong during a pregnancy or during a labour. We have a plan to move the Coombe to the James's site, but as the Master knows very well, the sequencing of that plan is the Children's Hospital needs to be built first, for logistical reasons, and then the Coombe will then be built on that site. What I have done and have received funding in the capital plan now is to go ahead and appoint a project team to look at how we can do the preparatory work for that move. So look, I share the frustration of any master who's in an antiquated building doing an excellent job day in, day out, but these are major, major capital projects. When the Children's Hospital is completed, we'll then build the Coombe, and we will then have a real centre of excellence, cradle to grave type care on the site at St James's.
Recently on the programme as well, we met some people about this this difference in law between the biological mother and the birth mother. And there was a protest recently outside the Dáil, and I believe that you met some of the people that we were talking to on air.
Yes.
And there's some sort of move towards resolution of that.
I'm meeting them today at 3 o'clock. I need to try and I suppose explain this in a simple form. When we went out as people and voted rightly for marriage equality in this country, a piece of legislation had been passed in advance called the Child and Family Relationships Act. And what that legislation basically does is allow for both parents in a same-sex relationship to register their name on their kid's birth cert. And I have a job to do to commence parts of that law to make that happen. And I'm doing that today. So today at 3 o'clock, I will sign the law that from the 5th of May means same-sex couples can register their names on their kid's birth cert. A really, really important move that will help many, many families and something people have been looking for a long time. There is another group of parents, and you'll read about it on the front page of the Irish Times also today. It's the lead story in the Irish Times today. There's another group of parents who perhaps have had a child by surrogacy, and surrogacy has not been regulated in our country to date, and they therefore have not been included in the Child and Family Relationships Act. And what I've said to them is that I want to work with them to come up with a way. They are parents just like I'm a parent, and they should absolutely have the same rights. From a legal and a constitutional point of view, you need to obviously balance the rights that the child has to know who their biological parents are, and that's an important right, but also the practical rights. These parents need to be able to bring their kids for vaccinations, make decisions in school, and you know, about healthcare and the likes. So today we'll sign an important piece of law that will help many, many couples. And then next year we'll introduce the Assisted Human Reproduction Bill, which for the very first time will regulate IVF in Ireland and will regulate surrogacy in Ireland. And I think that'll be a great help to many.
I'm trying to return to a previous subject, just sure. The Mesh. Did I get from you when you think you will meet the Mesh survivors?
Oh, sorry, I'm meeting the Mesh survivors on Monday.
Monday.
Next Monday.
That's great. Okay. Yeah. A constituent of yours, Sarah Dixon, mother to Martin from Newcastle. Where do we stand regarding medical cannabis?
Yeah, really good question. And I know Sarah, and I know Martin as well. Two parts to that question. As of today, anybody can get access to a medicine that's not authorised through applying for what they call a ministerial licence. So I've signed about 20 ministerial licences providing cannabis-based products to patients in Ireland, but it has to be recommended by a doctor. So if your treating consultant writes into the minister of the day, which is me at the moment, and says, look, I believe this child or this adult needs medicinal cannabis, those licences are granted. We have about 20, I think it's about 22, over 20 of them so far. The second part, though, and I think what Sarah's probably asking about, is I'm bringing in what they call a compassionate access program for three conditions: for epilepsy, for vomiting from chemotherapy, and for MS. I've changed the law to allow suppliers of cannabis-based products bring in medication to the country for those three conditions. And we're currently in the process of companies applying for a license through the medicines regulator. So I would expect by the end of the year, if not sooner, that we'll have product in Ireland in that regard. And that will then people can access it obviously on the basis of a doctor's prescription, the same way as you access any other medicine in the pharmacy.
Okay, let's come to the general difficulties that people have with the health service, the long waiting lists, the psychiatric nurses and what they had to say on Friday, some dreadful conditions they were outlining, shortages of staff. People are very annoyed about this and don't seem to be taking on board any improvements that might be there because they actually don't see them.
And I understand if you're in a busy emergency department today, you may not see an improvement, and your absolute priority and frustration is obviously getting seen now, or making sure your loved one is seen now. But we have seen, and I will answer the direct questions, but we have seen improvements in the Irish Health Service. A boy or a girl born in Holles Street today has a great chance of living to be 100. You or I have a chance of living above the European average. We've better outcomes in relation to cancer, stroke. These things don't happen by accident. They happen because we're investing a lot of money in health. And you know, if government gets the blame for everything that goes wrong, I think it's important then when things actually do go well, that government investment is seen as a part of that. In relation to staffing, we are increasing the number of staff working in the Irish Health Service every single year. Every single year. More nurses, more doctors. There's 125 more consultants working in Ireland this year than last year. They're official published.
Retention?
Do we need more? Yes.
No, retention. Are you still holding on to them though?
Yeah, well, there's a net. Sorry. I want to be clear, we have recruitment and retention issues, and I want to talk about that, but I'm just saying on a like-for-like basis, there are 125 more consultants working in Ireland this year than last year. I've started talks with our consultants about their own pay and their own conditions, because I do believe there's a legitimate issue there that's affecting recruitment and retention. We've agreed a new nurses contract that sees our nurses and our midwives being paid more, and we've agreed a new GP deal that sees all of the cuts brought in by the last government being reversed. Waiting lists for hospital operations. There's fewer people waiting for a hospital operation now than when I became minister. Where there's a real challenge, hands up, is the area of outpatients, which is really, really, really very large waiting list at the moment. Last month, we saw the first fall in outpatients in quite a long time, and I expect we'll see a second fall this time. So I can tell you today what we're going to do on a day-to-day basis to try and improve the situation. The answer, though, is one word, and it's called Sláintre Care. It is the 10-year plan that we now have to reform the Irish Health Service. It's not just my plan. Every single party in the Dáil has signed up to deliver it. What does that mean? It means we're breaking up the HSC. It means we're creating 6 regional authorities. It means there'll be fewer managers and layers of bureaucracy working in the HSC. And it means we're going to have universal healthcare, where you won't be able to have a consultant using a public hospital bed for a private patient while Mrs. Murphy's waiting in the ED on a trolley, and some consultants upstairs using our public bed to carry out a private operation. But this is a big, big, big project, and I'm up for it, and I hope to God I'm allowed to remain as health minister after the next election and actually get on with the plan, because we have a roadmap now to reform the Irish Health Service.
Yeah, it's funny when you hear say, oh, it'll be this, that and the other because we're breaking up the HSE into these regions. The same argument was put when we had all the breakup anyway and they were all put together for the HSE. There'd be less political interference, there'll be more centralised.
And the answer's in the middle. So we're not getting rid of the HSE, we're slimming it down. There are certain things you have to do at a national level. You couldn't have had the National Cancer Strategy or the National Maternity Strategy, in fairness to my predecessors, if you didn't have a central body. You shouldn't have, in my view, health boards with lots of county councillors on it making decisions. You shouldn't. But at the same time, it's gone too centralised now. Like, this is a small country. There are too many layers between the patient and the hospital today. There's too many managers. There's duplication of structures. And you know, this is not just me saying it. People in the HSE, good people in the HSE, are saying this as well. People are disempowered by the current structure. So we do need to break it up. There needs to be greater accountability. And regions need to be allowed to say, look, in our area, the big challenge we have is home care. And this year we're going to prioritise home care. And actually, in another part of the country, the big issue we might have is cataracts, and we're going to prioritise cataracts rather than just, you know, this one size fits all approach.
You said you're hoping to make progress with the consultants, though recently one branch of the consultants voted a no confidence in you. And could you take a second question on that and say, have we got fully qualified consultants? Because we heard that we might have consultants whose specialty is not what they're actually working at.
Well, look, I found it somewhat interesting that I invited one consultant body into talks on pay, and within a couple of days, the other consultant body that wasn't invited in decided to make that decision in relation to me. So look, I think there's a degree of inter-union rivalry there. I want to work with consultants. I'm not interested in playing politics or, you know, people sending out kind of sharp tweets or press releases. We've excellent doctors in Ireland, and we need to fix the health service together. We need to keep our best and our brightest here in this country, and that is going to mean paying our consultants more. Let me just be very clear about that and let our consultants hear me say that very clearly this morning. If we want to keep properly trained, properly qualified, best and brightest here in our own country, we do need to look at their work conditions. It's not all about pay. They want access to theatres and the likes as well. But pay is definitely an element. And you have two people today in a hospital, one who happened to be taken on a few years after earning very significantly different salary to the other person. That doesn't seem fair. But I do need to say as well, it's not all about what I have to do. They're going to have to do things differently too. I do not believe it's right. And I don't believe anyone would think this is right in any other sector, that you can skip the queue in a public hospital if you have private health insurance. I don't think it's right. I have private health insurance. I can afford private health insurance. What about my constituents who can't? And the idea that in a crowded hospital today, there are people on trolleys, public patients, while some of our public beds are being used for private practice, is absolutely unfair. It, you know, in fairness to Donough O'Malley, he copped this in education back in, what, the 50s, and said every child has a right to secondary education on the basis of, you know, an equal access. It's the same with healthcare. I mean, the idea, if I said to you today, you know, that in one classroom, you know, some kids get to sit up at the front because they can pay more and learn more, and the others have to sit down the back, you'd say, geez, that's appalling. That's what's happening in our health service, and it's not right, and it has to end. That's going to involve very significant contract negotiations. It's going to cost a lot of money, and it's going to take a bit of time. But I'm absolutely determined to do it, because until we do it, we won't have a fully equitable health service.
Well, what about people who decide to maybe forego lots of things in order to have private health insurance?
And they've every right to do so, and they'll continue to have private health insurance, but... And there are private hospitals for that. There are many around here. There are many around here, and this is not something you do overnight. I'm talking about a 10-year journey here. But in the UK, I hope I get my figures right here, but in the UK, I think only about 12% of people have private health insurance. In Ireland, roughly, it fluctuates, but roughly between 45 and 50% of people have private health insurance. As we build a better health service, as we free up those beds that are currently being used for private practice so public patients can get in quicker, hopefully families in Wicklow and other places won't feel the need to take out what's often a second mortgage payment in a month, in terms of trying to meet the cost of healthcare. People are not taking out health insurance because they can necessarily afford it or they want to. They're taking it out because they're worried about access. If we start to fix access, you'd hope less people would actually feel the need to rely on private health insurance.
There's often radio ads about how wonderful a private hospital is. Oh, I had this big injury or whatever, spinal injury, I think it's the latest one for the matter. I'm going to mention them. The patient is on, oh, sure, the treatment was absolutely next to nothing that you could ever get anywhere. And I'm up running there, so thanks to the matter. Can you get equal whatever techniques they're using in the matter by going to a public hospital?
Yes, you can. And you know what? People say to me, like,
I mean, is there a difference in treatment?
No, I mean, I know there isn't. And I mean, obviously from a public point of view, and this is absolutely fine, we always talk about the negatives in the health service, and I understand why, and it's right there highlighted. But when you're health minister, every week you get a couple of dozen letters or cards from people around the country telling you of their positive experience. And the one thing that people always tell me is, you know, I was a public patient and I had cancer and I got really great treatment. I was very sick and I was really well looked after. When you get into our public health service, the care can be second to none. The outcomes are improving. If you just look at all of the metrics, cancer, stroke and heart being the three big areas, massive improvements in each of those areas. There's 365 fewer deaths from stroke in Ireland now than there were only 10 years ago. So real progress is being made in the public health service. And it's important we say that too. You know, we ask why more people don't want to work in the public health service, and then we spend all our time bashing the public health service. You know, there's really, really good things that happen every single day in the Irish health service. The job I have to do is to try and make access quicker for people. We're seeing some progress on hospital operations. Waiting lists now falling quite significantly. Fewer people waiting for a hospital operation.
Still a lot, though, Simon. Come on.
Most people will now have their hospital operation in 6 months or less. Many of us will have our hospital operation in 3 months or less. Outpatients is a different kettle of fish, right? But I mean, if you look at cataracts, there were over 5,000 people, I think, waiting over 9 months. That's down to 500 now. So the investments we're making are actually making a difference. And of course, you'll always hear, and understandably hear, about the person who waited long. But I guarantee you, there's people listening to this program today who either were in a hospital themselves, or their mother or father was in a hospital, and they had a positive experience.
Indeed. You know, but as you say, the outpatients, physiotherapy for kids, orthodontist waiting list. I mean, there's just seems to be growing and growing numbers of young kids waiting for basic things, and the problem with kids is they're growing at the same time, so the effectiveness of treatment is going to be less.
Absolutely, and the answer to that, I'm really glad you brought this up. We've built 127 primary care centres around the country. There's one being built on this very road here we're in that'll open next year, the Bray Primary Care Centre. There's one in Wicklow, there's one in Blessington, there'll be one in Bolton Glass. We're building them all over our county, and we have 127 of them open around the country. The idea here is that you can go to the primary care centre and not have to go to the hospital. We'll have an x-ray facility in the one in Bray, for example. You won't have to go to Vincent's or Loughlinstown anymore. The issue, though, is, if I'm to be really honest, they're not adequately staffed. So if we want to really take people out of the hospital into primary care, we need to significantly increase staff. I'm not just commenting on it. I now have funding to hire, by the end of the year, 1,000 extra people to work in primary care. That's more speech and language therapists, physios, OTs, public health nurses. This will be the game changer if we can build up the workforce in the community and put diagnostics into our primary care centres. That's launch a care in action, but it will make a real difference. And the second point I'd make is we've started now piloting speech and language therapy and occupational therapy in schools. In some schools in West Wicklow now, we now have the speech and language therapists and the OTs going into the school. We're evaluating the pilot now, but what I'm hearing from parents who've seen their kids go through it is it's working very, very well. That's a model they use in the UK and other countries. It helps improve access, and it's something I'd like to roll out nationally.
I'm sure people would be pleased that it's all getting better, but there are the frustrations there.
Of course,
the state of the nation. There's the housing situation. There's a growing anger with people. There's a lot of antisocial behaviour around. There seems to be an underlying anger. And the politicians then, last week, you saw all the scandals about the expenses and things and walking around money and being in two places at the same time. And politicians get, you know, roaming charge pays when roaming charges in the EU have been done away with. That people just get angry and say, these guys are creaming it, but look at what's outside on the street. And we've got the homeless situation, we've got the housing, we've got the problems in education, we've got the problems in the health service. So, Yeah, you can you understand the anger that's there?
But if there was, of course. But if there were no issues, there'd be no need for politics. There'd be no need for politicians.
They're big issues.
But they're different big issues. If I was sitting in this studio 10 years ago, Declan, 5 years ago, you would have been talking to me about people in mortgage difficulty. You would have been talking to me about the fact that unemployment was up at 15%. You would have been talking to me about the fact that emigration was happening and the people were losing their kids to Australia and the United States. We've really made huge progress in some of those areas, but there's a huge amount now we need to do. We lost a decade due to the economic crash. And when you talk about anger, yes, I understand anger, but there's a need for responsible public debate as well. And I've been thinking a lot about the Wicklow situation that we had in Wicklow town relatively recently, where there was a decision to locate some asylum seekers, some refugees in the hotel. And indeed, you and I spoke on this programme about it at the time. And, you know, there was lots of worry in the community at the time. There was lots of anxiety. I saw RTÉ News go back there. Now, it's worked really, really well. So I just hope, and I often say to other communities around the country who are worried about some of these issues, look at what's actually happened in Wicklow. We welcomed people into our community. They've integrated really well in our schools. And so I think we just have to, I think sometimes we have to have balanced, reasonable discussion.
Okay, well, I'm going to throw something balanced here.
Yeah,
you know, not normal for me to defend situations like that, but I'm going to. I'm going to say for a place like Achill or whatever, basically, underneath it all, as far as I can figure out from the people there, is we never hear from you. We never hear from politicians or anything about doing anything for Achill. The first thing we heard from them was, they want to have people stay in our community who are not here before. Well, why is the only thing we hear something like that?
So firstly, I don't know if that is true. I do believe communicating.
They feel left out of the society for anything that goes.
We're a nation of immigrants. I mean,
No, that's not the point I'm saying.
But I think it is the point a bit. If I'm not talking about Achill, right? But if we announced today, if you and I were sitting here today in a different county, and there was an announcement that there were 200 new houses going into a rural area, I'm sure there'd be a lot of excitement. People would be saying, isn't this great? More people coming to our area, you know, repopulation of a rural community. Yet we now see a situation where people from another country are actually coming. We see.
I know you're trying to pin it on that,
but I feel very passionately about it.
Yeah, but the thing is that if they got a visit from Simon Harris and said, listen, down here we're going to make sure that you've adequate number of GPs, or your people who are waiting on hospital appointments in Castlebar Hospital are going to be reduced and all that. But no, we don't hear anything from politicians.
Yeah,
the only thing we hear is, I tell you what, we have this problem where we have people entitled to protection and safe housing, etc., and we're sending them to you, and that's the only thing you ever hear from us.
Well, I think if you'll excuse me for saying this,
I'm sorry that I'm defending people that maybe have ulterior motives, but that would be
a very superficial analysis of the situation. I was in Castlebar actually opening their hospice only a few weeks ago. I was in Portiuncula announcing a 50-bed extension to their hospital on Friday. I just think any time we get into a them and us mentality, I think it's very dangerous. Our country, through very difficult times, the centre has held, and I don't even mean that in a political sense. We came through a really difficult economic recession. We've managed to integrate new people into our communities very well. We've managed to pull ourselves back up as a country, and yes, we still have real challenges ahead. And I just think it's really important that we don't allow anything to ignite that would in any way undo. Well, you know, this is a country of Cead Míle Fáilte, and if any country understands the values of immigration and the importance of new people coming in, it's Irish people. We help build the United States, and we expect it to be welcomed there. Regularly, the Irish government is going to the United States asking and standing up for Irish people living there. We need to do the same. And I must say, though, I'm very, very proud as a Wicklow TD that any time this debate comes up, my email gets flooded by people saying, we need to do more. We need to do more to help refugees. We need to do more in relation to overseas aid. You know, we are a mature, wealthy, independent country. We want to take our place among the countries of the nation of the world. So that doesn't mean we can't do better in terms of how we communicate with communities. Of course we can. But fundamentally, we have a duty here to these people, and we need to step up in that regard.
From the constituents, just to finish up, and thanks for coming in this morning, Simon.
Thank you for having me.
What about the poor ambulance service response times? I am nearly 3 years waiting on an MRI. Paul says, I was on asking a question when the minister was on with Valerie about the Arklow healthcare unit. When is it opening? There was no details then. I got a letter last week to say waiting time for outpatient ENT appointment, 202 weeks. And another country, Simon Harris, would have resigned over the cervical check scandal and the National Children's scandal.
Let me just respond to that. I'll respond to them all if you want, but you may not have time. But on the cervical check one, the people who I actually care about in relation to this are the people who are impacted. People like Vicky Phelan, people like Lorraine Walsh, people like Stephen Teep. And ask any of them how they feel. I've dealt with an issue that was not of my making. It would happen long before I was in office. But read Vicky Phelan's, I'd invite that listener to read Vicky Phelan's book and see what Vicky Phelan has to say about how I handled the issue and how I dealt with her from the moment I became aware of this situation. I'm actually very proud out of a very difficult situation, a really, really difficult and upsetting situation. I'm very proud that we have worked incredibly hard with amazing women to the point now where we can say as a country we're going to eradicate cervical cancer within a generation. This is a cancer we can actually get rid of in our country. And we're going to do that. And that's thanks to people like Vicky, Lorraine Walsh, Stephen Teep and others who out of the most difficult situation have really stepped up. And I'm proud to have worked with them. Look, in relation to waiting times, I mean, my view on this is very clear. I'm not here today suggesting everything is great in relation to waiting times. Of course it's not. But what I am saying is there's significant money going into outpatient waiting lists now as a result of the budget. And I expect outpatient waiting lists to
finally, the ambulance then.
And the ambulance. Ambulance response times in Wicklow are actually in general in line with average. We have more money for the paramedics this year. I'm currently finalising the National Service Plan with the HSE, and I expect that we'll see extra. In fact, it will see additional resources for our ambulance service.
Okay, Minister for Health Simon Harris, thanks very much for
thank you so much,
this morning. And that's a big brief, isn't it?
We covered quite a bit there, yeah.
Okay,
even outside our brief.
I hope listeners were happy with some of your answers there. Thank you very much indeed.